Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to a very special edition, an in-depth, original investigative reporting series, Fluoride, a Deadly Legacy. It has required more than 2 years of in-depth research, over 220 interviews, and reading thousands of documents, scientific studies, and abstracts to be able to get a perspective on what is this entire issue of fluoridation. Why are we still fluoridating our cities if the evidence shows that it's dangerous to our well-being? Who are the individuals proposing that fluoride is safe and effective, that helps everyone with their teeth? This will be the topic of this analysis. At the completion of this 2 or possibly 3 day series, all of the information, footnotes, references, of which there are many, and a complete text of the investigation will appear on GaryNull.com, along with the other in-depth investigative reports on fluoride, vaccines, Ritalin, Prozac, genetic engineering, etc. There is nothing like a glass of cool, clear water to quench one's thirst, but the next time that you or your child reaches for one, you might want to question whether that water is in fact too toxic to drink. If your water is fluoridated, the answer very may well be, yes, it is toxic. For decades, we've been told a lie. A lie that has led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Americans and the weakening of the immune systems of tens of millions of more. This lie is called fluoridation, a process we were led to believe was a safe and effective method of protecting teeth from decay, is in fact a fraud. In recent years, it has been shown that fluoridation is neither essential for good health nor protective of teeth. What it does is poison the body. We should all at this point be asking how and why public health policy and the American Medical Association and the American media continue to live with and perpetuate this scientific sham. Let's take a look at how to market a toxic waste. Quote, "We would not purposely add arsenic to the water supply, and we would not purposely add lead, but we do purposely add fluoride. The fact is that fluoride is more toxic than lead and just slightly less toxic than arsenic," unquote. And that is from a reference in Clinical Toxicology and Commercial Products, 5th edition, by Dr. Yamianis. These words of Dr. Yamianis may well come as a shock to you because if you're like most Americans, you have positive associations with fluoride. You may envision tooth protection, strong bones, and a government that cares about your dental needs. What you've probably never been told is that the fluoride added to drinking water and toothpaste is a crude industrial waste. It is a byproduct of the aluminum fertilizer industries and a substance toxic enough to be used as rat poison. How is it that the Americans have learned to love an environmental hazard? This phenomenon can be attributed to a carefully planned marketing program begun even before Grand Rapids, Michigan became the first community to officially fluoridate its water in 1945. As a result of this ongoing campaign, nearly two-thirds of the nation has essentially and enthusiastically followed Grand Rapids' example. But this push for fluoridation has less to do with a certain concern for America's health than with industry's penitent for expanding at the expense of our nation's well-being. The first thing you have to understand about fluoride is that it's the problem child of industry. Its toxicity was recognized at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution when in the 1850s, iron and copper factories discharged it into the air and poisoned plants, animals, and people. In the early years of the 20th century, young dentist named Frederick McKay settled in Colorado Springs, Colorado. There he discovered that as much as 90% of the lifetime residents of the town had grotesque brown stains on their teeth, and that the tooth enamel had an irregular surface texture, described as mottled. Locals referred to the familiar condition as Colorado brown stain, but had no clue as to what caused it. Over the next two decades, Dr. McKay later, with the help of dental researcher Dr. G.V. Black, proved that the cause was something contaminating the water supply. They also speculated that the affected teeth might be somewhat more resistant to decay. By the 1920s, rapid industrial growth had exacerbated the problems of industrial pollution, and fluoride was one of the biggest problems. Medical writer Joel Griffith explains that it was abundantly clear to both industry and government that spectacular U.S. industrial expansion and economic and military power and vast profits it promised would necessitate releasing millions of tons of fluoride waste product into the environment. Their biggest fear was that if serious injury to people were established, lawsuits along the way would happen, and that would devastate the companies. And while public outcry could force industry-wide government regulations, billions in pollution control costs, even mandatory changes in high fluoride raw materials and profitable technologies. So, in 1931, by means of photospectrum analysis by McKay and Black of water samples they conducted at the laboratories of the Aluminum Company of America, that time it was called Alcoa, it was confirmed that the cause of mottled teeth was fluoride in the water supply. Alcoa took a proprietary interest in the issue, since fluoride is a major waste product of aluminum production. The company wanted to know how much fluoride exposure could people tolerate without getting mottled or discolored teeth. Or more specifically, how much fluoride could Alcoa release into the nation's earth, water, and air without the public realizing that the company was polluting the environment with a powerful toxin? That question was to be addressed later that year when H. Trindley Dean was sent to study water sources in 345 Texas communities. Dean, a former dental surgeon for the U.S. Public Health Service, was then head of dental hygiene unit of the National Institutes of Health. Dean's overseer and mentor at the U.S. Public Health Service had been Treasury Secretary Andrew Mellon, a founder and major stockholder of Alcoa. Based on his own research, Dean claimed that, quote, fluoride levels of up to one part per million in drinking water did not cause mottled enamel. If the fluoride exceeded this level, however, fluorosis would occur, unquote. Now Dean remembered McKay and Black's claims that fluorosis victims' mottled discolored teeth were especially resistant to decay. He came up with the notion that fluoride added to the water supply at the magic threshold dosage of one part per million would prevent tooth decay while avoiding damaging bones and teeth. He recommended further studies to determine whether his hypothesis was true. Back at the Mellon Institute, Alcoa's Pittsburgh Industrial Research Lab, this was galvanizing news. Their biochemist, Gerald J. Fox, immediately fluoridated some lab rats in a study and concluded that fluoride reduced cavities and that, quote, the case should be regarded as proved, unquote. In a historical moment in 1939, the first public proposal that the U.S. should fluoridate its water supplies was made not by a doctor, not by a dentist, but by Cox, an industrial scientist working for a company threatened by fluoride-damaging claims and burdened by the odious expense of disposing of tons of toxic industrial waste. Cox began touring the country, stumping for fluoridation. Dean would go on to carve out a neat, nice little career for himself as the so-called father of public water fluoridation. He became the first dental scientist at the National Institutes of Health, advancing to the director of the dental research section in 1945. After World War II, he directed epidemiological studies for the Army in Germany. When Congress established the National Institutes of Dental Research in 1948, Dean was appointed its director, a position he held until retiring in 1953. In his post at that position, he was to oversee the first clinical trial fluoridation in an American city. That was Grand Rapids, Michigan. With those impressive credentials, wouldn't you think a man of science like Dean could be trusted? think again. The truth is that Dean's great discovery was based upon wishful thinking and some very shaky science, as documented by all of the research I've uncovered, not the least of which is Dr. Andreas Schuld's work, including the fluoride story. Dean's findings did not stand up to scientific scrutiny whatsoever. An independent study of his results revealed that he had engaged in, quote, selective use of data, unquote, employing figures from 21 cities that confirmed his findings and ignoring those from 272 other cities that did not. Today, we would consider that grounds for challenging not just all of his findings, but that would be such junk science it would never see the light of day in any credible journal that had proper scientific review. But this is 1955. And in a 1955 court case challenging fluoridation, Dean admitted under oath that his published conclusions were wrong. In hearings conducted in 1957, he was forced to admit that dental fluorosis, the first sign of fluoride overdose, could be caused by water fluoridated at one part per million. And who at that time conducted these hearings? The AMA. Interesting how today it supports fluoridation. At that time, it had the evidence that it did not work. But these admissions were not widely publicized, and they were never acknowledged by the U.S. Public Health Service, which actually employed Dean, or the American Dental Association, which championed Dean, or the other governmental bodies responsible for foisting fluoride on the public. They continued to play the classic denial game, act like nothing's wrong, and they all still are doing that to this very day. So just so that we're very clear, let me put this in perspective. Virtually all the science that initially supposedly proved that fluoride at one part per million was safe and would not cause dental fluorosis and protect your teeth was a fraud. And this was proven under testimony. I have the testimony as part of what it takes when you're doing this kind of investigative reporting. Get the details. Stay neutral. Get your facts. Make your conclusions after you have these facts. And all along, the public has not known these facts existed. Dentists were not aware of these facts, because no one went looking for them. At first, industry could dispose of fluoride legally only in small amounts by selling it to insecticide and rat poison manufacturers. But Dean's so-called discovery paved the way for a commercial outlet for a toxin. Griffiths writes that this was not a scientific breakthrough, but rather part of a, quote, public disinformation campaign by the aluminum industry, quote, to convince the public that fluoride was safe and good, unquote. Industries need prompt and now co-funding scientist Gerald Fox to announce a, quote, the present trend towards complete removal of fluoride from water may need some reversal, unquote. The big news in Cox's announcement was that this apparently worthless byproduct, fluoride, had not only been proven safe in low doses, but actually beneficial. It might reduce tooth decay, he said, in children. A proposal was in the air to add fluoride to the entire nation's drinking water, and while the dose to each individual would be low, fluoridation on a national scale would require the annual addition of hundreds of thousands of tons of fluoride to the country's drinking water. Government industry, especially Alcoa, strongly supported intentional water fluoridation. It made possible a master public relations stroke, one that could keep scientists and the public off fluoride's case for years. If the leaders of dentistry and medicine and public health could be persuaded to endorse fluoride in the public's water, proclaiming that the nation had a wide margin of safety, how were they going to turn around later and say industry's fluoridation pollution was dangerous? As for the public, if fluoride could be introduced as a public health enhancement substance, well, then they're going to argue it's for the children's sake. Then what would it seem to anyone who would oppose it? You'd look like a quack or a lunatic. Now, back at the Mellon Institute, mind you, this is one of the most powerful men in America. He helped form public opinion. He was Secretary of the Treasury. He had the ear of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So that was earlier. He was one of the confidants. Well, now they've got their research going full force. And Alcoa sponsored Gerald Cox. And that's all it took, just a little work with some laboratory rats. And then he says, we don't need any more. We've proven on a few rats it can prevent tooth decay, period. Well, having worked in a laboratory for many years and been director of research of clinical studies and nutrition at the Nutrition Institute of America and the Institute of Applied Biology, I can tell you, you can't prove anything from a study on rats and fluoridation. But nonetheless, he had no peer review. He had no one challenging him. And he had no one disputing that fluoride could cause damage. So once their plan was put into action, industry was buoyant. They had finally found the channel for fluoride that they were looking for. How do we get rid of this terrible toxic waste? Ah, let's sell it. Let's make a profit. Let's make the public think that they're getting something good. And they were even cheered on by dentists and government agencies and the public. Chemical Week, a publication of the chemical industry, describes the tenor of the times. It says, quote, all over the country, slide rules are getting warm as waterwork engineers figure the cost of adding fluoride to their water supplies, unquote. They are riding a trend urged upon them by the U.S. Public Health Service, the American Dental Association, the state dental health directors, various state and local health bodies, and vocal women's clubs from coast to coast. It added up to a nice piece of business on all sides, and many firms are cheering the Public Health Service and similar groups as they pump for increasing adaptation of fluoridation, unquote. Such overwhelming acceptance allowed government and industry to proceed hastily, albeit irresponsibly. The Grand Rapids experiment was supposed to take 15 years, during which time health benefits and hazards were to be studied. In 1946, however, just 1 year into the experiment, six more U.S. studies adopted the process. By 1947, 87 more communities were treated with fluoridation. Popular demand was the official reason for this unscientific haste. Kind of sounds like AZT and AIDS, doesn't it? The general public and its leaders did support the cause, but only after massive government public relations campaign spearheaded by Edward Bernays, a nephew of Sigmund Freud. Bernays, a public relations pioneer who had been called, quote, the original spin doctor, unquote, was a masterful PR strategist. As a result of his influence, almost overnight, the popular image of fluoride, which at the time was being widely sold as a rat poison and bug killer, became that of a beneficial provider of gleaming smiles, absolutely safe and good for children, bestowed by a benevolent paternal government. Its opponents were permanently engraved on the public mind as crackpots, white ring loonies. Well, the opposition to fluoridation is usually associated with right wingers. This picture is not totally accurate, and I would like to provide a historical perspective on the anti-fluoridation stance. Fluoridation attracted opponents from every point on the continuum of politics and sanity. The prospect of the government mass medicating the water supplies with a well-known rat poison to prevent a non-lethal disease flipped the switches of delusionals across the country, as well as generating concern among responsible scientists, doctors, and citizens. Moreover, by a fortuitous twist of circumstances, fluoride's natural opponents on the left were aligned with those on the right. Oscar Ewing, a Federal Securities Agency administrator, was a Truman Fair dealer who pushed many progressives in this direction of nationalized medicine. fluoridation was lumped with his proposals. Inevitably, it was attacked by conservatives as a manifestation of creeping socialism. And while the left rallied to support fluoridation, yes, the liberal community loved fluoridation, and the left considered it an essential public health issue, this would later come up of an issue, because during the McCarthy era, the left was further alienated from the opposition when extreme right-wing groups, including the John Birch Society and the Ku Klux Klan, raved that fluoridation was a plot by the Soviet Union and the communists and the government to poison America's brain cells. It was a simple task for promoters, under the guidance of the original spin doctor, to paint all opponents as deranged, and they played this angle to the hilt. Actually, many of the strongest opponents originally started out as proponents, but changed their minds after a close look at the evidence, and many opponents came to view fluoridation not as a communist plot, but simply as a capitalist-style con job of epic proportions. Some could be termed early environmentalists, such as the physicians George Walbot and Frederick Exner, who first documented government industry complicity in hiding the hazardous waste pollution from the public. Walbot and Exner risked their careers in a clash with fluoridation defenders, only to see their cause buried in toothpaste ads. By 1950, fluoridation's image was a sterling one, and there was not much science could do at this point. The Public Health Service was fluoridation's main source of funding, as well as its number one promoter, and therefore caught in a fundamental conflict of interest. If fluoridation were found to be unsafe and ineffective, and laws were repealed, the organization feared the loss of face. Since scientists, politicians, dental groups, and physicians unanimously supported it. For this reason, studies concerning its effects were not undertaken. The Oakland Tribune noted this when it stated that, quote, public health officials have often suppressed scientific doubts, unquote, about fluoridation, of course. Walbot summed up the situation when he says that from the beginning, the controversy over fluoridation of the water supplies was a political, not a scientific health issue. The marketing of fluoride continues. In 1983, a letter from the Environmental Protection Agency, then Deputy Assistant Administrator for Water, Rebecca Hammer, writes that the EPA, quote, regards fluoridation as an ideal environmental solution to a long-standing problem. By recovering byproduct fluorosilicic acid from fertilizer manufacturing, water and air pollution are minimized, and water utilities have a low-cost source of fluoride available to them, unquote. More recently, in 1992, a policy statement from the Department of Health and Human Services states, quote, a recent comprehensive Public Health Service review of the benefits and potential health risks of fluoride has concluded the practice of fluoridating water is safe and effective, unquote. Is it? Well, if you're a government scientist, you got to say yes. If you support it, you got to say yes. If you're a dentist, you got to say yes. You see, there's just too much to lose for honesty. And when was the last time we ever had any issue dealt with honestly from the get-go? Never. Not in the environment that we have today. Today, nearly 250 million people worldwide drink fluoridated water, including over 130 million Americans. 9,600 communities fluoridate their water. Out of the 50 largest cities in the United States, 41 have fluoridated water. To create this whole environment took a massive program. And then to celebrate fluoride's widespread use, the media recently reported on the 50th anniversary of fluoridation in Grand Rapids. A newspaper article titled Fluoridation, a Shining Public Health Success. And another one, by the way, after 50 years, fluoride will still work with a smile. Painted glowing pictures of the practice. Had they done their homework? Had they not just been used as shills as PR flacks for the special interest groups? Had they really been investigative, they would have seen at a more close look that all they had to do is learn from the children in Muskegon, Michigan, an unfluoridated control city. They had equal drops in dental decay. They might also have learned of the other studies that dispute the supposed wonders of fluoride. The fact is, the fluoride myth doesn't hold water. The big hope for fluoride was its ability to immunize children developing teeth against cavities. Rates of dental caries were supposed to plummet in areas where fluoride was treated by, or the water was treated with fluoride. Yet decades of experience and worldwide research has contradicted this expectation numerous times. Let me just share some specific, detailed, factual examples. In British Columbia, only 11% of the population drinks fluoridated water, as opposed to 70% of the Canadian population. Yet, British Columbia has the lowest rate of tooth decay in Canada, with 11%. In addition, the lowest rates of dental caries within the province are found in areas that do not have their water fluoridated. According to a Sierra Club study, people in unfluoridated developing nations have fewer dental caries than those living in industrial nations that do fluoridate. As a result, they concluded, quote, fluoride is not essential to dental health, unquote. In 1986-87, the largest study on fluoridation and tooth decay ever was performed. The subjects were 39,000 school children between the ages of 5 and 17 living in 84 areas around the country. A third of the places were fluoridated, a third were partially fluoridated, and a third were not fluoridated at all. Results indicate no statistically significant differences in dental decay between fluoridated and unfluoridated cities. The benefit of fluoridated communities, if there is any, amounts to 0.6 fewer decayed teeth surfaces per child, which is less than 1% of the tooth surface in a child's mouth, making it statistically insignificant. Hence, there is no difference. I repeat, no difference. None. Zero. Zip. Between fluoridated and unfluoridated. A World Health Organization survey reports a decline in dental decay in Western Europe, which is 98%. Non-fluoridated. They state that Western Europe's declining dental decay rates are equal to and sometimes better than those in the United States. A 1992 University of Arizona study yielded surprising results when they found that, quote, the more fluoride a child drinks, the more cavities appear in the teeth, unquote. Let me repeat that. The University of Arizona said, in young people, the more you drink fluoridated water, the more cavities you have. Hence, it actually creates cavities. Although all Native American reservations are fluoridated, children living there have much higher incidence of dental decay and other oral health problems than children living in almost any other community. A 1999 study of water fluoridation in Italy shows that parents' socioeconomic status, the area of their residence, a children's sweets consumption are more significant predictors of dental caries and fluoride consumption. The authors conclude that universal fluoridation is an inadequate approach and a decision to fluoridate or defluoridate water requires careful epidemiological consideration. A 2001 article in the Journal of the American Dental Association admits that the fluoride that is swallowed and incorporated into teeth is, quote, insufficient to have a measurable effect on reducing cavities, unquote. This is a stunning admission from the American Dental Association, historically one of the principal supporters and defenders of water fluoridation. A follow-up of the study of the town of Kuopio in Finland 6 years after fluoridation was discontinued found no increase in dental caries. The authors conclude that fluoridation was unnecessary to begin with. A study comparing prevalence and incidence of caries in 2,994 lifelong residents of British Columbia in Canada, grades 5, 6, 11, and 12, found that dental caries increased was not different between the still fluoridated and the fluoridated ended communities, no difference whatsoever. In 1997, following the cessation when they stopped fluoridating the water in La Salle, Cuba, dental caries prevalence remained at a low level for the 6 to 9-year-olds and appeared to decrease in the 10 to 11-year-olds. In the 12 to 13-year-olds, there was a significant decrease without fluoridation. And while the percentage of cavity-free children of this age group had increased from 4.8 in 1973 when the water was fluoridated to 33 in 1982. That's 52% increase in reduction of tooth decay after the water was stopped being fluoridated. A 1998 study conducted in New Zealand found that, quote, when the timing of various forms of fluoride supplementation is correlated with the decline in caries, the decline continues beyond the time of maximum coverage with fluoridated water and fluoridated toothpaste. The authors calls for a complete reassessment of effect of fluoride. Quite simply, it doesn't work. In contrast to the anticipated increase in dental caries following the stopping of fluoridation of water in German cities, a significant fall in tooth decay prevalence was observed. This trend corresponded to the national caries decline and appeared to be a new population-wide phenomena. When they stopped fluoridating water, tooth decay went down. A 1999 New York State Department of Health study of 3,500 7 to 14-year-olds showed that children in fluoridated Newburgh, New York, have no less tooth decay but significantly more dental fluorosis than children in Kingston, New York, which has never been fluoridated. Since 1945, children of the two towns have been examined periodically in order to demonstrate that fluoridation reduces tooth decay. Quote, this new research shows the experiment has failed, unquote. In light of all the evidence, fluoride proponents now make more modest claims. For example, in 1988, the American Dental Association professed that a 40 to 60% cavity reduction could be achieved with the help of fluoride. Now, they claim 18 to 25% reduction. Other proponents mention 12% decline in tooth decay. And other former supporters are even beginning to question the need for fluoridation altogether. A National Institutes of Dental Research report stated, quote, it is likely that if caries in children remain at low levels, or decline further, the necessity of continuing the current variety of and extent of fluoride-based prevention programs will be questioned. This is a startling claim coming from the very same government organization that spearheaded the drive for compulsory water fluoridation. A 1999 review of literature conducted by Dr. Harvey Limeback, a longtime advocate of fluoridation of water, indicates that the topical effect of fluoride is its primary mechanism for the prevention of dental caries. Swallowing fluoridated water is ineffective and unnecessary. Limeback concludes that everyone working in the dental field must examine more carefully the risks and benefit of fluoride in all of its delivery forms. According to Dr. Limeback, head of preventive dentistry at the University of Toronto, he says, dental decay rates in North America are so low that water fluoridation provides no benefit whatsoever these days. In fact, studies show that when you turn the water fluoridation taps off and look for dental decay rates, they do not move whatsoever. There is no increase in dental decay when you stop fluoridating. Limeback adds that what you do see is an increase in unsightly dental fluorosis. That's the brown spots. Today, fluorosis occurs in more than about 30% of children where water is fluoridated, and not all of it's in its mildest form. That's very high, 1 in 3. In a letter published in 1999, dentist and public health official Dr. John Coulihone, formerly one of New Zealand's most prominent pro-fluoridation advocates and educators, explains how over the course of years he came to recognize that there was no benefits in water fluoridation and that children's dental health is slightly better in non-fluoridated areas than in fluoridated ones. Now, most government agencies, however, continue to ignore the scientific evidence and to market fluoridation by making fictional claims about its benefits and pushing for its expansion. For instance, according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, quote, national surveys of oral health dating back several decades document continuing decreases in tooth decay in children, adults, and senior citizens. Nevertheless, there are parts of the country, and particularly populations, that remain without protection. For these reasons, the U.S. Public Health Service has set a national goal for the year coming up that 75% of persons served by community water systems will have access to optimally fluoridated drinking water. Currently, this figure is about 60%. Well, the goal to have this year all the water fluoridated, or most of the water fluoridated, is challenging. And based on past progress and continuing evidence of effectiveness and safety, we have to question this. Now, their statement is quite simply flawed on several points. First, as we've seen, research does not support the effectiveness of fluoridation for preventing tooth disease. Second, purported benefits are supposedly for children, not adults, and not senior citizens. At about age 13, any advantage fluoridation might have occurred comes to an end, and less than 1% of the fluoridated water supply reaches this population. And third, fluoridation has never been proven safe. On the contrary, numerous studies directly link fluoridation, normal fluoridation, we're not talking about large amounts, small amounts, type you'd drink in a single glass, or when you're washing vegetables and fruits, fluoride's on there. We can associate this with brain and kidney damage, Alzheimer's disease, lead poisoning, and several forms of rare cancers. I would assume that this alone would make most people reconsider drinking any fluoridated water. Let's go a little further on this problem I have with fluoridation. Only a small margin separates supposedly beneficial fluoride levels from amounts that are known to cause adverse effects. Dr. James Patrick, a former antibiotics research scientist at the National Institute of Health, describes the predicament. He says, quote, there is a very low margin of safety involved in fluoridating water. A concentration of about one part per million is recommended. In several countries, severe fluorosis has been documented from water supplies at only 2 or 3 parts per million. In the development of drugs, we generally insist on a therapeutic index margin of safety of at least the order of 100. A therapeutic index of 2 or 3, not 100, is totally unacceptable. Yet that's what it has been proposed by the public health services. Other countries argue that even 1 part per million is not safe. Canadian studies, for example, imply that children under three should have no fluoride whatsoever. The Journal of the Canadian Dental Association states that fluoride supplements should not be recommended for children less than 3 years old. Now, since these supplements contain the same amount of fluoride as water does, they are basically saying that children under the age of 3 should not be drinking fluoridated water at all, under any circumstances. Japan has reduced the amount of fluoride in their drinking water to 1/8 of what it's recommended in the United States. Instead of 1 milligram per liter, they use less than 15 hundredths of a milligram per liter as the upper limit allowed. The 1 part per million dosage recommendation of fluoridation of our water has a checkered past, and its present is even more problematic. And as we've seen, the first mention of this so-called magic number was made by Dr. Trinity Dean, who jiggled his research results to reach the conclusion that, quote, fluoride levels of up to 1 part per million did not cause modeling of the enamel. And if the fluoride exceeded this level, however, fluorosis would occur, unquote. But the adoption of this dosage for water fluoridation was not Dean's brainchild. It was set in 1953 by Dr. Held Hodge, then chairman of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences Committee on Toxicology. Unfortunately, Dr. Hodge made a serious miscalculation in his estimate of the safe dosage level of fluoride. His figures err by a factor of 2.25, which means that they understate the toxicity of fluoride considerably. And the story of this potentially fatal miscalculation is told in a document from the United Kingdom's National Pure Water Association. Now, it's important when any new drug is marketed that the dose at which it is toxic is determined. There is then a margin of allowed safety, usually a factor of 100, and a maximum dose is published. In 1953, the National Academy of Sciences published their estimate of the quantity of fluoride, which produces the condition known as crippling skeletal fluorosis. The calculation was done by a famous toxicologist, Harold Hodge, Ph.D., who was chairman of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences Committee on Toxicology. To arrive at his figures, Hodge cited a classic study of the effect of fluoride among cryolite workers by the European researcher Kaj Rolm, and published in 1937. Rolm's dosage figures were presented in milligrams of fluoride per kilogram of body weight. In his study, Rolm showed that levels of 0.2 to 0.35 milligrams per kilogram, some workers developed crippling skeletal fluorosis in a very short time. The first stage of the disease appeared in general at 2.5 years, stage 2 at 4.5 years, and the crippling skeletal fluorosis at 11 years. Hodge wanted to apply Rolm's figures to a typical range of body weights in order to set a maximum intake level of fluoride in milligrams per day. But Hodge was American and used to dealing in pounds rather than kilograms. By using a range of body weights from 100 to 229 pounds, he multiplied 0.2 milligrams figure by 100 pounds, giving a figure of 20 milligrams per day, and 0.35 milligrams by 229 pounds yielded 80 milligrams per day. Thus, the amount of fluoride, which would cause crippling skeletal fluorosis, he said, were 20 to 80 milligrams per day. And rather than quote Rolm's 11-year figure for crippling fluorosis, he gave a range of 10 to 20 years. These are the figures that appeared in the American Dental Association's pamphlet, Fluoride Facts, and on which many other articles are based, even today. But Hodge made a simple but significant error. Rolm's figures were not pounds. They were milligrams per kilogram figures. Unfortunately, Hodge was the expert, and no one apparently checked his figures. This error, which gave a full safety margin more than doubled what it should have been, went unnoticed for decades. It was not until Darlene Sherrill tried to duplicate Hodge's arithmetic and couldn't make it add up. She worked out that Hodge had made an error when he neglected to convert pounds to kilograms. Now, correcting for this error, Sherrill reduced the amount of fluoride needed to be crippling to 10 milligrams per day for 10 years. But fluorides accumulate throughout our lives, so a higher intake will have the same effect in a shorter time, and smaller doses of fluoride will have the same effect in a longer time. So if we apply Rolm's dosage figures to a lifetime, let's say you live, 55 to 96 years, just 1 milligram per day, the amount in 1 liter of water for each 55 pounds of body weight could be crippling to you. In 1989, Sherrill wrote to the National Academy of Science and asked on what they based their 20 to 80 milligram per day figure of fluoride. 2 years passed before the Academy told her that they had identified Hodge's interpretation of Rolm as the data source. 4 years later, the error was finally corrected by the National Research Council's Board on Environmental Studies and Toxicology. In their 1993 publication, Health Effects of Ingested Fluoride, where they changed the figure from 20 to 80 milligrams per day to 10 to 20 per day. Now, as it happens, Hodge had written a chapter in a book released in 1979 entitled Continuing Evaluation of the Use of Fluorides. In it, Hodge had correlated his previous published figures, but nobody seemed to notice. In 1991, when the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services published their review of fluoride, risks and benefits, they continued to use the old figures, and that would cause crippling bone deformities. Indeed, the current RDA and dietary reference intakes published by the Institute of Medicine in 1997. So you thought you could trust the National Academy of Science for its jumping on something when it's wrong? Forget it. Part of the problem, not part of the solution. And they're strongly subsidized by special interest groups. In fact, they're virtually dominated by special interest groups. I, quite frankly, do not accept anything the National Academy of Science says about anything. And scientifically, I'm embarrassed at the lack of intellectual accuracy in so many of their statements. If you had a lobotomy, you'd be smarter than most of the people who converse down there. They are an embarrassment, intellectually embarrassing. Let's take a detailed look at the myths. And these myths are very hard to dislodge. When a big lie is said enough times and enough people embrace it, there's almost too much damage if people simply surrender the myth. We can get a good idea of how much fluoride is safe by working with Rohm's figures. Now, you'll remember that after the figures have been corrected, the amount needed to cause crippling fluorosis in a 100 to 229-pound person was reckoned to be about 10 milligrams a day for 10 years. Now, since fluorides accumulate in a linear fashion, the crippling dosages of 10 milligrams per day for 10 years is the same as 5 milligrams per day for 20 years, and so on. If we extrapolate this to a normal lifespan with fluoridated water, this is the same as 2.5 milligrams per day for 80 years. But take note, for persons with kidney disease, the risk is greater because less fluoride will be eliminated by a malfunctioning kidney. It's also important to realize that these figures are for crippling our fluorosis. The last stage, it would take only 4 years at 10 milligrams a day, or 16 years at 2.5 milligrams per day for a 100-pound individual to experience phase 2 musculoskeletal fluorosis with chronic joint pain and arthritic symptoms, with or without osteoporosis. Now, that is the amount of fluoride found in just 2.5 liters of water, and that's without counting the extra that today is inevitably found in foods, toothpaste, etc. Let me put it a little different way. It comes down to this. We do not have a standard by which we can say that these 100 million Americans are all the same. They all have good, healthy immune systems. Their body could handle a certain amount of immune assaults and recover easily. To the contrary, we have over 200 million Americans who are suffering from chronic or acute illnesses, whose immune system is grossly challenged. And therefore, people who are on soft drinks, getting a lot of fluoride in that, people who are using different mouthwashes, lots of fluoride in that, easily the average American could be consuming 20 milligrams of fluoride a day. And at that level, then it is grossly immunosuppressive. And how would then we then know that so many Americans with arthritis don't have their arthritis because of fluoride? Because it's been shown that skeletal fluorosis is one of the symptoms, and if you just have too much fluoride, which is very easy to get, remember, actually one of the smallest ways you get is from the drinking water. You get a lot of other ways as well, and I'll get into that in another part of our series. So from this, it is clear that the only safe limit of fluoride is none. Even supposing that low concentrations are safe, there's no way to control how much fluoride different people consume, as some take a lot more than others. For example, laborers, athletes, diabetics, and those living in hot or dry regions can all be expected to drink more water, and therefore more fluoride in fluoridated areas than others. And due to such wide variations in water consumption, it's impossible to scientifically control what dosage of fluoride a person receives via the water supply. In 50 Reasons to Oppose Fluoridation, Dr. Paul Conant, professor of chemistry at St. Lawrence University in New York, states that the supposedly safe fluoride level in our water may pose a particular danger for any of the millions of Americans who suffer from thyroid disorders. And he explains, early in the 20th century, fluoride was prescribed by a number of European doctors to reduce the activity of the thyroid gland for those suffering from hyper or overactive thyroid. Just refer to the Merck Index, 1960, page 952, for that, and later on in other editions as well. So it was common. Bad medical practice, but it was common. With water fluoridation, we are forcing people to drink a thyroid-depressing medication, which could serve to promote higher levels of hypothyroidism, underactive thyroid, in a population, and all the subsequent problems, such as depression, fatigue, weight gain, muscle and joint pains, increased cholesterol levels, and heart disease. That's what comes from being underactive in your thyroid. So what are we doing? We're actually giving people water fluoridation as a medication. It bears noting that according to the Department of Health and Human Services, fluoride exposure in fluoridated communities is estimated to range from 1.58 to 6.6 milligrams a day, which is a range that actually overlaps the dose of 2.3 milligrams I gave earlier to show the decrease in the function of the thyroid gland. Now, this is a remarkable fact and certainly deserves great attention considering the rampant and increasing problems of hypothyroid in the United States. In 1999, the second most prescribed drug of the year was Synthroid, which is a hormone replacement drug used to treat an underactive thyroid. More than 20 million people in the United States received treatment for thyroid problems, and many others are thought to go undiagnosed. Even in my own health support groups, I must have 40% of the people who have underactive thyroids and generally have depression and are overweight and fatigued as just some of the side effects and localized pain. And by the way, 90% of the fluoride added to our drinking water is no longer the sodium fluoride at all. Today's fluoride is industrial waste that is complexed with silica and sodium. Fluoride complex with silica or sodium is really ionized to free fluoride ions that are quickly absorbed in the gastrointestinal tract, whereas when chemically bound to calcium, less of it ionizes and less is absorbed. So calcium inhibits fluoride absorption and is, in fact, the treatment of choice for fluoride ingested overdose. Now, another concern is that fluoride is not found only in drinking water. It's everywhere. Fluoride is found in foods that are processed with it, which in the United States includes nearly every bottled drinking thing and canned foods. In fact, researchers writing in the Journal of Clinical Pediatric Dentistry have found that fruit juices, in particular, contain significant amounts of fluoride. In a recent study, a variety of popular juices and juice blends were analyzed, and it was discovered that 42% of the samples examined had more than one part per million of fluoride, with some brands of grape juice containing up to 6.8 parts per million. The authors cite the common practice of using fluoride-containing insecticide in growing grapes as a factor in these high levels, and they suggest that that the fluoride content of beverages be printed on the labels, as is other nutritional information. And considering how much juice some children ingest, and the fact that youngsters often ingest a particular brand that they consume day after day, labeling seems a prudent idea. Clean water activist Jeff Green points out that fluoride is in Wheaties at 10 parts per million, 10 times the amount that you find in water. It's in post-grape nut and shredded wheat and Fruit Loops. These are items that I'm sure you have not consumed or are not now, nor would you advocate, But these are items that people all over the United States are eating without realizing that they have fluoride in them. Who would have thought that Wheaties has 10 parts per million? But it does. And because it's a pesticide residue that's allowed to be on produce, now it's taken a big jump, and the EPA has allowed it to be at really high levels. Give you an idea. 180 parts per million for a head of lettuce. 55 parts per million for raisins. No child is going to wash it all off. And prepared baby foods are a problem, too. A 1997 article in the Journal of the American Dental Association warns that some baby foods contain such high levels of fluoride that babies who eat the food risk dental fluorosis. Any infants who regularly eat more than a couple of ounces of infant foods containing high fluoride content chicken would be at elevated fluorosis risk, the authors conclude. Infants who eat large quantities of dried infant cereals reconstituted with fluoridated water could ingest substantial quantities of fluoride from this one source. The study showed, quote, children should also be monitored to make sure that they do not ingest too much fluoride from other sources, such as fluoridiferous fluoride, dietary fluoride supplements, or fluoridated water, unquote. And that's just part of the story. On tomorrow's program, of course, I'm going to continue and give even more information in probably 2 to 3 parts. The series is entitled Fluoride, A Deadly Legacy, and it will be appearing on GaryNall.com. Now, just a few program announcements before we come up to the end of the program here. I will be continuing next Monday and the Monday after that in an area of trying to bring differing points of view together on WBAI. Keep in mind, when I'm asking people's questions, my purpose is not to harangue people or to badger them if I find or if I believe that they have given an incorrect answer. I will be, I have been making notes of what I consider inconsistencies in virtually everyone's comments, but I believe that it is best and most appropriate to go back to each of these individuals with a list of all the questions that I feel require re-examination and offer them an opportunity to give a contextual answer. I'll be doing that. You see, the difference is I've done my homework, and I want to get these people to give as true and honest statements as possible. And when I sit here and I hear statements that I absolutely know are incorrect, there is a point to where I must stop in my challenging. But it does not mean that that information will not be forthcoming at some point. It will be. But I believe it's always best to give people an opportunity to redress these issues. And so there will be a forum for that. I'm also arranging for the very first meeting to bring people together to start this healing process. And I'm very pause about this. I also found out that, by the way, go to livereads.com. One of my books just hit number one, Barnes & Noble. You didn't even know about it, but it's up there. I'm happy about that. Tomorrow I would tell you about a computer service that's carrying my radio show all over the world live free every day. I didn't even know it existed. I just found out today. But it's got a long bunch of letters and numbers, and I'll give that to you tomorrow. So no matter where you're at in the world or anywhere else, any of your relatives or friends, I should say, anywhere else, they can hear this show every day anywhere in the world on their computer, and it's crystal clear. I didn't know it. Now I do, and I'll share that with you, and I'll give that information tomorrow. You all have a nice day.